This is the sworn statement of Tamar Hegan. Today's date is November the 11th, 2008. The time is approximately 5:45 in the evening, Eastern Standard Time. The statement is being taken over the phone. Ms. Hegan, would you acknowledge for the record that you're aware that I'm tape recording this conversation?
Absolutely, I am aware and give my permission.
And you understand this is a sworn statement, and that when we get to the end of it, I'm going to ask you to swear or affirm that the statements you've made are true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief.
Absolutely.
I have represented myself to Ms. Hegan to be Bill E. Branscombe, a private investigator employed by the law firm of Robert Bernhoft from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the Bernhoft firm having an interest in an individual that she has known as Troy David Stratus. Ms. Hegan, when and where and under what circumstances did you first meet Troy Stratus?
I met Troy Stratus in September of 2002, at which time I was looking for work and was put in contact with his company Next Level Media through mutual acquaintance who indicated they were looking for a receptionist. I applied for that position and received it that same day and began working for him the very next day.
And where would this have been?
I did not. This was Next Level Media's offices were located in the Waterfall Building on the, West 2nd Avenue in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. The office space occupied a large commercial suite in the building, and Mr. Stratus also leased several, I think about five or six living units inside the same complex. At the time that I was employed or began my employment with Next Level Media, Mr. Stratus had four office staff, myself, Janice Mahood as the CFO, a lady that was not with us for very long who was the office manager, and as a right-hand man, so to speak, Mr. Kevin Holden. In addition to that, he had a personal assistant who stayed with him most of the time, who was from Vancouver, and he had two individuals that came from New York, Mr. Miguel Rodriguez and his boyfriend, who were involved with the company, though we never had a very clear picture on what exactly it was that they did. When I began my employment with Mr. Stratus, it was represented to me that he was a producer of music, music videos, television shows, and possibly some movies, that he had come to Vancouver because Vancouver had a reputation as a relatively well-known movie industry, well-developed movie industry, and due to the difference in the dollar at the time between Canadian and U.S. dollars, he felt that his production money would go further in Canada than it could necessarily in the States.
What, if anything, did Troy Stratus tell you about his personal financial status?
He claimed to be a millionaire and or billionaire, depending on when you spoke to him about it. He did not indicate where he received most of his funds, just that he had quite a few. In general, he indicated that his wealth had come from working in the entertainment industry. He didn't allude to any specifics, but just claimed that his wealth had come from the entertainment industry.
Did you see any signs of wealth?
I did indeed. When I first started working for Mr. Stratus, he spent a great deal of money. Generally, he spent quite a bit on himself, but he was fairly generous initially with those people around him, wanted people to dress a certain way, so he would purchase clothing for them, wanted to have them do things for him, so he would purchase them items like bicycles, facials, and other types of things in order to get them to either agree with him or to show that he was, in fact, as wealthy as he claimed he was, spent lavishly on food and other items like that.
Now, when you say he spent lavishly, can you kind of amplify on
one
that a
specific,
little bit?
Well, one specific incident comes to mind where he came into town. He had with him one of his quote-unquote talent. I believe that he had his boyfriend, Terry Pepin, as well as a gentleman, John Prescott, with him, and took the entire office as well as these two individuals to a Vancouver area restaurant called Chin Chin, which is quite well known and often has celebrities dine at it, and for lunch had us at $100 a plate lunch for no particular reason outside of wanting to show that he could afford to do so.
Now, you mentioned a Mr. Prescott and a Mr. Pepin. Which of those was the boyfriend?
Terry Pepin was a Calvin Klein model who had some success in the modeling industry, was a French-Canadian from Montreal, and he was Mr. Stratos' boyfriend for a time. My understanding was that that it was a personal and professional relationship, in that Mr. Stratos had promised Mr. Pepin that he would assist pushing forward his career and possibly get him involved in acting as well as modeling. And then the personal aspect is that they did date and live together for a short time.
Okay.
John Prescott was initially introduced to me as Scott Metcalf. Mr. Stratos had him change his name to John Prescott because he said that it was a more marketable name in the music industry. He had been approached in L.A. I believe he had been working as a waiter at the time, and Mr. Stratos had seen him there. And had approached him and claimed that he wanted to produce music with him in the country and Western genre, in addition to possibly including him as a talent in any number of projects that Mr. Stratos was working on, from music videos for songs produced to television series that he claimed he was producing. The only specific television project I was aware of was called Plantation, was a sort of a nighttime soap opera style television show that he claimed he was going to get a number of celebrities to star in and also use as a vehicle for some of his newer talent.
Now, did you ever encounter an individual named Richard Hack?
I did indeed have a number of dealings with Richard Hack. I never met Richard Hack personally, but I did coordinate telephone conference calls, emails, and trips for Mr. Stratos to visit Mr. Hack in Provincetown. And I was aware that Mr. Hack had sent money and other items over the span of the year that I worked for Mr. Stratos in regards to a number of different projects and also as a friend. My understanding is that they had a long-term friendship, which may at one point have been a romance, but during the period in time that I knew Mr. Stratos, I never saw any romantic involvement between the two, and that they were business partners.
Okay. Now, when you say he was involved in projects, can you identify any of the other projects that he was involved with?
Specifically, he was involved with Plantation, but he also expressed some level of interest in some of Mr. Stratos' other projects, such as the Revlon building, which he was claiming to build be a property developer and was going to develop a massive, gaudy, lipstick-shaped tower in Las Vegas for Revlon Cosmetic Company. He was involved with Troy regularly, but only had his name on one or two items, and then the rest of the time he basically was either sending money, advice, or correspondence to Mr. Stratos.
Were they partners?
As far as I'm aware, yes, and that there was some legal issues surrounding Mr. Stratos from his time in Hawaii, and Mr. Hack had some involvement either as an advisor or otherwise in trying to resolve those conflicts. It was represented to me when I started at Next Level Media that those issues with a gentleman named David Rush in Hawaii were in fact fraudulent, and that the only reason that a judgment had been placed against Mr. Stratos was because he had been misinformed and had missed the appearance date in court, and therefore the judgment automatically sided in favor of the plaintiff, and that he was in the midst of working with a number of lawyers in the Los Angeles area to have that verdict overturned. It was regularly represented to me that any day now the entire situation would resolve, but it did not resolve in the entire time that I was there.
What would you know about any celebrities that he might have had dealings with or be involved in projects with or anything like that?
Mr. Stratos claimed a very large number of projects, including he claimed that he was working on Miss Nancy Wilson's life story, that he was working to develop a comeback album for her, and that he was working to get her a Lifetime Achievement Award Grammy. He represented that he knew Michael Jackson and that he was working with Michael Jackson to develop some kind of comeback. He represented that he had known Whitney Houston, and if Bobby Brown and Whitney Houston ever broke up, that he would assist Whitney with regaining her career. He represented that he was going to produce a project for Donna Summer, a Broadway musical of her life story, as well as a comeback album and music video to go along with it. Another project that he claimed he was working on would have involved Britney Spears and Prince William of England. He claimed that he had connections in England and that he was going to produce a song and music video that would represent Britney Spears as a princess locked in a tower with Prince William coming to rescue her. He represented numerous real estate deals that did not have anything to do, as far as I could tell, with the entertainment industry. He represented that he was either a close friend or business associate of Mr. Simmons, who at the time was the president of Def Jam Records, and that he was going to work on some kind of music project with that person. In addition, he had projects around Samantha Ivey Burton, his sister, represented that he was recording her music and was going to produce and produce her music, and she was going to be the next big R&B hit, as well as a number of other small talent that were unknown, like John Prescott, that he claimed he was going to bring them in and they would be the next big thing in their genre of music.
Now, did he represent to you that he was funding all of these various projects himself?
He represented that he was funding some of it himself, but in general, most of the funding came from investors who would invest in these projects and provide him monies to get production underway. In general, he presented that his own funds were held up overseas for a time, and that that the investors would be paid back either by himself when that was done, or by product of work and the completion of projects. He was involved in non-entertainment projects as well. In Vancouver, he, with a woman named Ann Chasen, was supposed to purchase a Krispy Kreme donut franchise, and that did not happen. And in fact, in one phone call, we were told it had blown up in her face because he had failed to meet an obligation under the franchise agreement. He claimed that that people would receive monies after projects had earned revenue.
Do you have any idea how much Ann Chasen had invested in this thing that blew up?
I don't know for sure. I think it was in the tens of thousands of dollars. She also had some association with Vivi True, who through her association with Troy, became convinced that she was in love with him, and gave him substantial amounts of money. I'm aware of at least $2 million that was handed over that I saw wire transfer documents or funds transfer documents for, but I am under the impression that there was a great deal more money that changed hands that I did not have direct evidence toward.
Now, the millions of dollars, however many million it was, that Vive True provided, do you know what that money was supposed to go for?
Various projects. At one point, Vive True was on the board of directors for Next Level Media, or was involved with the board and was as a funding partner. But as far as I know, from the various real estate deals that Troy had represented, he was going to close. There was certainly money from that was expected to get to Vive. He had a number of homes at least 20 or 30 home residential and commercial real estate deals that he claimed to be working on at any given time. None of them ever came to fruition from large commercial real estate buildings to developing new buildings to purchasing luxury homes or multi-million dollar homes for himself, as well as to rent out to celebrities who were filming in Vancouver, and also to provide to his staff or other people as a means to provide security, he claimed.
Now, do you have any direct evidence or any direct knowledge that any of the money that was provided to him by any of the investors was not used the way it was represented to be used?
Absolutely. I absolutely know that monies that were provided to Troy for investment purposes, for projects, were not spent on projects. Instead, they funded his lifestyle, his gambling habit, and providing lifestyle benefits to those who were at the moment the chosen and were close to him. At any given time, he had between 3 and 5 people that he would string along or have along with him as an entourage, and would spend lavishly on those people for a time until he got bored of them or they started to get wise, at which point he would begin a process of disincluding them in the group and taking more money or other items or resources from them. He would publicly humiliate people and claim that he'd changed his mind on whatever it was project he was going to do, and now he was going to do something else, and they were no longer a part of that plan. He pretty much just used somebody until he was done with them, or they got too close to the truth, and then he would try to make sure that they didn't have an opportunity to talk about what had happened to them, and in general represented them to anybody else that was around as somebody who was either bitter or gold digging or represent the issues that had come up as something perhaps more sinister than it was in terms of their involvement with him, that they were looking for something, they were trying to scam him, and so they were no longer to be a part of his life.
Now, in your position, were you in a position to have any close involvement with him and his personal life?
Yes, I had. Initially, I was hired as the receptionist. Over time, I became the office coordinator. But the truth of my position was, more often than not, my job was to manage Troy or to ensure that he had the things that he wanted for his lifestyle. I was required to purchase hygiene products for him, like baby wipes for the washroom instead of toilet paper. I was required to interview his boyfriend regarding some possible pornography he had been involved in and get a complete understanding of any sexual acts he may or may not have completed in a pornography movie that it came to light he was involved with. I was required to arrange meetings, to make phone calls on behalf of Mr. Stratos to talent agents and other companies, representing him as a wealthy producer who wanted to work with these talent agents' clients. I basically did pretty much whatever he wanted me to do. He would phone me up and tell me to make arrangements. I made travel arrangements. I sent him to, I know he went to Las Vegas, he went to Los Angeles, he went to New York, and he went to Switzerland, as well as he did visit Richard Hack as well in Provincetown. And he did take an entourage for a recording session to Puerto Rico. At the time, the claim was that they would get more work done in Puerto Rico. My personal belief was that it was a more impressive location, as John Metcalf was starting to become somewhat disenfranchised with Mr. Stratos because he was not seeing any progress on his recording deal. So Mr. Stratos took him to Puerto Rico as a way to say, hey, look, see, I really have a lot of money, and I really am interested in your singing, and let's lay down some tracks. I believe they did record a couple tracks, but they were never fully produced or put into a CD format or published to the world at large.
Now, did you say, I think you told me something about an Olympic presentation, production he was doing?
Yes, yes, Mr. Stratos did represent that he was a personal or family friend of the foreign minister or the minister of culture for the country of Greece, and that he was working with Next Level Media to develop a involvement or to produce the opening or closing ceremonies of the Athens Olympics. He also had some kind of business meeting with the folks at Nike. He wanted to have some kind of partnership with the Nike brand. I know that he did have a meeting with them, but any outcomes of that meeting I was never made aware of, and those outcomes did not come to pass while I worked there.
Now, you said that he was going to produce a comeback for Donna Summer. How did that work out?
It went so poorly in the end. Troy broke all his promises, that my understanding was that not too long after it really completely blew up, Donna Summer actually fired her representatives through the William Morris Agency because they had allowed her to come to harm, basically. He had gone to her home. He had many meetings with Donna Summer and with the William Morris Agency, and had made a number of promises for producing this project that did not fall through, promised an amounts of money that never came through, and eventually burned his bridges with those people in that circle because of it.
Of all the projects that you knew of him to claim to be involved in, whether they were real estate development projects or comeback projects or Olympic game projects or whatever they were, did he ever produce anything or actually follow through with anything to completion to where it actually worked out to either make money or to where he did whatever it was he said he was going to do?
No, I never saw a single project that Mr. Stratos started or claimed to start that ever went to production. I never saw a single thing make any money or be even in a state of readiness to make money. There were so many false starts. It began to feel to those of us in the office that they were simply make-work projects or projects intended generate new monies from investors with no hope of actually ever being completed. He, toward the end of my time with him, started an association with a gentleman from New Jersey called Mr. Charles Matar, who was supposed to be a conduit to the Middle East and to getting some monies that Troy claimed he had out of the Middle East. It was during that time that Troy began to, in earnest, claim a relationship with the royal family of Saudi Arabia. He claimed it was a family friendship and talked about going there and visiting and being involved with some projects for people who were going to assist with humanitarian aid in the Middle Eastern region, but that he had to keep those business dealings quiet because the United States government did not want Arabs providing assistance to Arabs in the area, but instead wanted a weaker relationship, and therefore he had to be careful about how he pursued that relationship, which made it easier for him to do from Canada, he claimed, because our country was not in the same position.
Well, now
it was about that.
Let me just ask you, as I understand it, to put this chronology in perspective, you actually got involved with Troy Stratus right after our 9/11.
Yes, it was not very long after 9/11. That's correct. It was less than a year. I started prior to the year anniversary of 9/11.
Now, how do you spell Matar?
M-A-T-A-R, Charles Matar.
Do you happen to know if he's the same Charles Matar that has an executive position with Merrill Lynch?
I do not know, but at the time that I knew Charles Matar, they did not represent which company he worked for directly. He was intended to be a conduit, but they didn't say where. I understand that he and Troy may have incorporated a company together in Milwaukee because they felt that the tax laws or something like that were better for incorporating there. They may also have looked at incorporating a company together in Vancouver or in Canada, British Columbia. I never saw any final product from that. I saw papers drawn up, but I'm not sure if they were ever filed.
Let me go back to something you said about Las Vegas. Do you know if Troy personally gambled?
Troy gambled an extensive amount. During the second half of my time as with Troy, while I was the office coordinator, part of my responsibility was taking all the receipts that he collected on his trips and putting them in order for the financial team. And I personally handled hundreds of thousands of dollars in gambling receipts from the Mandalay Bay hotel and luxury hotel in Las Vegas. Outside of staying in $4,500 a night suites and having the rest of his guests stay in these luxurious conditions and spending hundreds of dollars on every meal, he gambled a tremendous amount of money in a very short spans of time. There were very, very rarely any trip that he would take to Las Vegas that didn't involve at least $60,000 in gambling debts, and that was on the light side, the low side.
What would the high side be?
Upwards of $150,000 in a few days.
Okay. He ever get in trouble with that?
Yes, he did. In fact, at one point, he gambled the paycheck for our staff and lost all of the money that he was supposed to pay us with, and VV True gave him the money to pay the staff to ensure that there would be no missed paychecks.
And did he use the money that was provided by VV True to pay the payroll?
He did pay the payroll. I'm not sure if he actually used VV's money to do it or if it was somebody else's money, because he also gambled during that period as well, and I don't know where he received that money from.
Okay.
I do know that at one point after we... after we all quit, because we told him he was in breach of the contract that he had provided to us, that he had represented himself falsely, and that we were quitting. We left a list of monies outstanding based on the breach of contract, and Kevin Holden called Vivi and told her that that Troy owed us that money, and she gave Troy money to pay us, which he gambled and was unable to pay us and has not paid us to date.
So you do know for sure that there was money that Vivi True gave Troy for specific things that he did not use for the things that it was provided for?
That is absolutely correct.
Okay. Do you know, who is Gordon Love or somebody like that? I saw that name in some paperwork.
Gordon Love is a lawyer who represented Troy in Vancouver. He is a real estate lawyer and initially represented Troy on real estate issues alone. Troy did have him represent him on a number of other issues. And through Gordon Love, I did receive a token, which was intended to be a good faith payment toward the money I was owed, about $1,300. But I never received another penny after that. So Gordon Love worked with Troy on a number of failed real estate deals in the Vancouver regional area and in Whistler, where he had had represented to a number of people through Ann Chasen and her company Windermere Real Estate that he would be purchasing luxury homes and did not. Troy would routinely put $10,000 or $15,000 non-refundable deposits down on expensive properties and then allow the deposit to lapse because he was unable to seal the deal. But he felt that if he was able to lose money and people could see that he would lose money on his own choice because he changed his mind, then that would make him appear to have a great deal of money. So obviously if $10,000 is nothing to you, then you must really be rich because the rest of us can't afford to lose that much money and in a day, you know.
Well, how many properties do you think he pretended that he was going to buy and then didn't?
I would say that I saw here in Vancouver maybe 60 different properties, both commercial and residential. Plus he promised, and that's in Vancouver and in Whistler, plus he promised his mother, Ms. Stafford, to buy her a home in Oregon. He had her, I mean, he put his mother through this. He had his mother go and look at homes and find ones that were perfect, and he would turn them down and say, that one's not good enough for you, Mom. You need something better than that. That one doesn't have a big enough bathtub. That one doesn't have a nice enough rec room. And when she finally found something that was perfect, he would take it away, and then he would blame her and say, well, you're being mean to me, so I'm not going to buy you a house anymore, or would really just emotionally abuse her to a tremendous extent. And sometimes he would do this on speakerphone, so the entire office would be subjected to listening to her humiliation. And that was a very common tactic of Troy's, was to publicly humiliate his staff or associates or anybody else that was around him who didn't necessarily jump as high as he wanted them to jump at a specific instance, or who had any doubt about him or were showing any reasons that they may not have believed him. And usually his standard operation would be to publicly humiliate you. And if you cried, he would get absolutely furious and abusive. And then sometime after, usually not too long after, he would turn around and he would buy you something, give you money, buy you clothes, go get your hair done or get a facial or here's a bicycle in order to make up for that or to appear generous and magnanimous. I know you've done wrong, but I'm going to buy you something anyway because I care about you, was generally the way that he kind of went about doing those sorts of things.
Okay.
And when you talk about his own mother, he also had a stepmother, Nancy Wilson, who was actually, and I suppose is still actually, a successful jazz musician. And he, through his dealings in, again, which he claimed were fraudulent, dealings in with Dennis Rush in Hawaii, She actually had to file for bankruptcy protection because she was named in the judgment as well as Troy because she had assets that could be seized, and she had to try and protect her assets because it was looking increasingly like there was not going to be a settlement to that issue and that Troy was not going to come up with the promised money to take care of the judgment.
Now,
and there were a number of conversations, phone conversations in regard to that, that as his staff we became a party to.
Now, when you say that he said that it was a fraudulent deal in Hawaii, I would say that everybody agrees it's a fraudulent deal. But his representation to you, as I'm understanding it, was that he had actually been the victim of the fraud.
That's correct. He claimed that that they were working on a project, that investors had given him money for that project, and that for some reason the project had been held up, and one of the investors, Mr. Dennis Rush, had broken into the place that Troy was staying and had stolen a bunch of his possessions in an effort to retrieve some money prior to the end of the project, and that because his possessions had been stolen, he had moved away from Hawaii with all of his stuff and had decided not to continue that project, and that, in fact, the only reason a judgment went against him is because he had either not been informed or been misinformed of the date of the required appearance in court, and because he did not appear, the judgment went against him automatically, but that was all being dealt with, and very soon his lawyers would have it all worked out.
Now, do you know whether his version of the truth was consistent with the truth?
I do not believe that it was consistent with the truth, based on my own observational experience with Troy through the year that I worked with him, as well as after I stopped working with him, I went back and reviewed the legal documents and findings, and I do not believe that his version of the truth is correct. I will say that it is possible that Mr. Rush did see some possessions of Mr. Stratos, but I believe that those possessions were seized in accordance with trying to recoup some of the millions of dollars of losses that he had had suffered and may have been legal. I'm not familiar with the United States law in that regard, so I don't want to say that it was legal, but I know that in Canada, if you're owed money from a creditor, you can have your possession seized in order to pay that debt.
You know for sure there was a judgment, though.
I do know exactly that there was a judgment that went against Troy Stratos, and believe that the judgment was, even though the offense was in Hawaii, I believe the judgment was in California court because that's where Mr. Stratos was from, and that judgment is still outstanding to this day.
Now, did anybody have occasion to sue him in Vancouver? I mean, with all the properties and things, somebody must have gotten a little annoyed about that.
Yes, they did get annoyed. As far as I know, nobody sued him, but I do know that the Real Estate Association of the Greater Vancouver area did actually put out a warning against him to all of their realtors, suggesting that they do not show him properties because it is fraudulent and he would not actually be purchasing any properties on their behalf. When that happened, he became exceptionally furious. He tried to view a new property and was told no and told exactly why, and he contacted V.V. True and Ann Chasen and screamed at them to make sure that these people knew that he wasn't the fraud, that it was somebody else, and that they better show him that property if they want to make any money, and put forward a number of threats about taking his money and going elsewhere if this is how he would be treated. And for some unfathomable reason, they did as he requested, and he was shown the properties by those real estate agents. He did not buy any of the four properties that he had them show him, but he did have them show him the properties at least six occasions. He would walk through the properties with various members of his entourage and staff and talk about where he was going to put in a recording studio and where he was going to do other activities. In addition to that, a number of these specific properties were intended, as he represented it, to be given to his staff as gifts to provide for their security and as thank yous for their loyalty. None of his staff ever received any of the homes that he claimed they were going to receive.
Did he, was he ever foreclosed out of anything?
At one point, he had put actually quite a bit of money into one of the suites in the Waterfall building, probably about $150,000 to $200,000 in renovations, imported teak hardwood floors and all sorts of renovations. He was going to purchase this as well as portion of the entire property, and it got to a point where when he was about $25,000 or $30,000 in arrears for his monthly leases, that he was told by the owner of the property that they were going to foreclose on it or take it away, and so he instructed and had our office do basically a midnight move and pack up and move to a new location overnight, so that none of his goods could be taken. In addition to packing up the office, we were also required to pack up his personal belongings and the personal belongings of those people he had staying with him. And he left that property and instead went and stayed at a luxury, fully furnished luxury executive penthouse in Yale Town, Vancouver. That one was $7,500 a month that he stayed at there, and he was able to stay there, was still there at the point in time where I quit.
Now, I've heard stories from virtually everybody I've interviewed about his radical emotional mood swings and things. Did you ever see him do any of the "I'm having a breakdown, admit to the hospital, whatever" kind of things?
Absolutely. Mr. Stratos was exceptionally manic, as I say. He was very abusive to his staff, but he all and then generous on the flip side. But he had moments where he appeared exceptionally vulnerable and weak and required everybody to come. And the specific incident that I can think of involved his boyfriend, Terry Pepin, who left him. Because he did not feel that Troy had represented himself honestly, didn't think that Troy was going to help his career at all, and had seen enough, is what the way that he termed it to me. I've seen enough, and he went back to Montreal. When that happened, the entire office was required to shut down work and go to his penthouse and sit with him and hold his hand and tell him that we weren't going to leave him, and he had lots to live for, and it's going to be okay, and kind of go through these kinds of motions with him. From there, he spent the next 2 days or so, and this was during a time when John Prescott was in town. Over the next 2 days or so, we had to run around town purchasing items to put into a large antique trunk, to be sent to Montreal with mementos and other personal items to try and entice Terry to come back to Vancouver. In order to pay for that trunk, Mr. Stratos actually went to the Toronto Dominion Bank of Canada, where he had accounts, and had them put a stop payment on a check that he had written for travel that he had already taken. This was money owed to somebody. He made them stop payment on that check and then took that money, that $5,000, and purchased this lavish gift for his ex-boyfriend, I guess, at the time.
Well,
and that was only one of the...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, that seems odd to me, because for him to have to do that would suggest that he was out of money.
That's correct. And it was during that period of time where we had started to see over the prior few months bills start piling up and people phoning for money and investors calling upset about a lack of money. At one point, and I think this one really struck me quite a bit, there was one gentleman who phoned up. And this isn't a girl or even a young man. This is a grown man who has his own business, phoned up, and he was nearly in tears because Troy had promised him to pay him back some $50,000 that he had owed, and he was crying on the phone to me and saying, what am I going to do? When's he going to pay me? I need this money. And when I asked Troy refused to take this gentleman's phone call and insisted to tell him that he'd get paid, that Troy may pay late, but he always pays. That's what he said. As far as I am aware, he never did receive payment. He may have, but if he did, it was not during the period of time that I worked there.
Do you know any other major investors? You talked about a lipstick-shaped building. You talked about so many things. Did he have any other big investors that you know of?
He had a business partner in Las Vegas. Barry Meyer was a lawyer that he used to deal with that. He, as far as I know, Richard Hack had some investments, but I don't know which projects he invested in besides Plantation. He continued to take money from his stepmother, Nancy Wilson, with always the caveat that he was going to pay it back as soon as the wire transfer came through. That became a very familiar refrain with him. He had money from V.D. True. He had money from Ann Chasen. I know there were others with money. Charles Matar came in around that time. When he came in, Troy started to say that that's when the money from overseas was going to start to flow again, and he produced faxed copies of what he claimed were U.S. Treasury bonds that had been provided to the Saudi royal family during the 1970s for oil during that oil crisis, and he represented that these were now in his keeping, that he was responsible for this money, which was in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. They seemed legitimate, but having not had access to the actual document and having never seen a document like that, it seemed official, but I have no way to say if those were true documents or not. However, if they were true documents, none of the money that they represented ever seemed to come through. There was always being held up. At one point, he did go, and I booked him a trip, and I got him to Switzerland, Geneva, Switzerland, where he claimed he was working on a business deal as well. He was there, A, for a business deal, and B, to discuss some matters with his bankers. Again, I never saw money come out of that. But the claim that money was coming out of that did come forward.
To the best of your knowledge and belief, all of the money that you saw spent came from investors?
Yes, and the only investor that I personally saw hand in money on a regular basis was V.D. True. Beyond that, I know there were investors or wire transfers that came from Los Angeles. But how much, and that was usually between, $10,000 or $25,000, sometimes more. But who that money came from, I was not always made aware.
Did there come a time when, other than the one person that you mentioned, I mean, did you ever have investors calling you up saying, where's my money?
Yes, we did have a number of people call up and say, where's my money? And usually they were people that I didn't know, Troy made many trips to Los Angeles. And while he was there, he would wheel and deal and harangue people for money and then come back to Canada with his money and spend it. He had me FedEx his clothing to a Los Angeles area dry cleaner from Vancouver to Los Angeles to be dry cleaned at a company called Cleaner by Nature, because he said that they were the only, they didn't use chemicals in their cleaning. And that cost hundreds of dollars every time to ship it across the border and back. He was involved heavily with his own sister, stepsister, I guess. He had so much plastic surgery done to her by Garth Fisher, because I suppose she had been overweight as a child, that he had a great deal of plastic surgery done and tried to have a project where he had her on Extreme Makeover. However, by the time that he started that, she had had so much plastic surgery done already that they would not accept her on the show. In Los Angeles, worked with a gentleman named Lorenzo Pryor, who had was a music producer and had a recording studio. They'd had some kind of previous relationship together. Lorenzo was one of the people who would phone and ask for his money, but he seemed to have had a prior relationship with Troy and was a little bit more skeptical of the whole thing, depending on where we were at. And he would, he called for money. Some of the talent that, were supposed to be getting these big deals were asked to spend money that he promised he would pay them back. And I'm not aware of him paying anybody back, any monies that he had borrowed from them.
Now, do you know of any occasions, because it's a story that I've heard a lot, where people were duped into using their own personal credit cards to pay for things, expecting to be reimbursed, that just didn't happen?
Yes, absolutely. That was one of the common ones that I would get phone calls from. Like I say, often it was talent. Sometimes it was his friends. Sometimes he would go out with actual talent agents from Los Angeles or wherever, and they would pay for things expecting that he would be, billed for it, but he never paid it back, or expecting in kind. And what he would do usually is when he first showed up, he had lots and lots of money and would spend lavishly, so that when he didn't have a lot of money on him, you could believe that, oh, it's just a momentary thing, there's a wire transfer or whatever. We don't understand foreign banking. They don't necessarily realize that Canada isn't all that foreign, and it really doesn't take very long for money to transfer. And so they would pay for things because he had already set up the expectation that he could afford to repay them, but never would he repay them. Or at least he didn't, to my knowledge.
Now, you say there came a time when the office quit.
Yes, we basically got to a point over a period of time from when I started. The office manager was there for a month or two before she quit, because Troy publicly humiliated her over being 5 minutes late for a meeting in front of most of the office staff, a number of waiting staff at the restaurant in Whistler that they were at, and she basically felt that she could not continue to work for him, that she didn't need the job that badly, was how she put it. So she left, and 2 or 3 months after that, his personal assistant, I'm not entirely clear on what happened when they were away, but she was on a trip with him to Los Angeles, and something happened that was so traumatic for her that she actually locked herself in her hotel room and called Vancouver almost hysterical, asking for us to get her a flight home because she couldn't handle being there anymore. She was scared for her personal safety. She said that Troy was freaking out. And at that time, she had contacted Troy's right-hand man in Vancouver, which was Kevin Holden. Kevin had been given instructions not to book a flight for her and was unable to do so, at which point she said she was going to call her boyfriend. Her boyfriend contacted the office and said, if you don't get her home right away, I'm going to call the RCMP. This is forcible confinement or it's kidnapping or it's something. You can't keep her there. Eventually, Kevin was able to convince Troy that he just needed to let us get her home, which we did, and I never saw her in the office again. So a few months after that, Miguel Rodriguez and his boyfriend returned to New York Not entirely sure what the circumstances of that return was, but it didn't seem terribly favorable from Troy's perspective. So at this stage, we were left with myself, Kevin Holden, Janice Mahood, and we hired a new receptionist as I became an office coordinator, and the new receptionist's name was Larkin. She was young, student just out of university, and really was there only for a month or two before basically we all decided to quit, and we basically looked at the situation, which deteriorated over the year. Initially, we all believed Troy. He had a lot of money. I mean, we saw him go through a full $1 million in 1 month. We honestly believed he was what he said he was, and so we worked very hard for him. However, as time went on, it became increasingly clear that he had no money of his own, that he had no intention of fulfilling promises that he had made to people prior, and that the money that he was receiving was not going for projects, that none of the projects that we were spending our time working on were ever going to come to fruition. So as a group, we decided that the only thing we could do in good conscience was to quit, because we were concerned that even though we had not yet missed a paycheck, that it was not something that we could see that it would come down the pipe soon. The fact that he nearly missed a paycheck was one, but also even if he did pay us, we were not confident that that money was legitimate money that we would receive. We weren't sure who he would take money from to pay us, and so we, as a group, while he was in Los Angeles, left her cell phones in the office, locked up, dropped her keys through the mail slot, and left. When Troy found that out, he came back to the office, and he tried to contact myself. I know that he did not contact any of the other individuals. I think he knew better of it. Janice was an older lady, and she probably got wise a little bit faster than we did, maybe, and Kevin was very upset that he had been personally betrayed by Mr. Stratos, and it wouldn't have gone well for him to speak to Kevin. So he chose me because I was young. I was 22 or 23 at the time. I had a two-year-old daughter at home, and although my husband worked, we really needed two incomes. So he felt that I was a good mark, that I was the most vulnerable person in the group, and he spent several hours on the phone with me trying to convince me to come back and work for him. He offered me $50,000 up front in cash if I would come back for a full year and basically being paid in advance, which I did not do. First off, I didn't believe that he had the money to pay me, and second off, I didn't want it. I didn't want to work for him. I didn't want to take money that I knew was probably, you know, somebody's life savings. So I did not go to work for him, at which point he found new staff and for a time maintained his office in Vancouver. I don't know how long he maintained it, but it doesn't seem to me that it was particularly long before he was gone from here. After I left Next Level Media, I contacted as many of the people that I knew that he had represented business dealings with, and warned them that Mr. Stratos was not what he appeared. As far as I could see, he did not have the funds that he claimed to have, and that I had seen him misusing funds that he had received for projects for personal reasons, and that most of his interest in the talent was not truly professional but personal, that he liked to collect people to give him legitimacy, but that he was never going to produce a record or an opportunity or a television program. Most of the people that I spoke to did not believe me and did not receive my warning very well. My only hope is that in the end, it provided them with enough food for thought that when they started to see the pattern themselves, they were able to get out of it a little bit earlier than maybe they would have otherwise.
I don't imagine Troy appreciated you warning all of his potential marks. Did he do anything to retaliate or get even or threaten you or anything about that?
When I talked to him, he tried a number of tactics to get me to come back. He tried flattering me. He tried promising me money. He tried threatening me. He tried saying, oh, well, you're going to ruin the life of your daughter. you know, I'm just trying to think of your little girl. I can forgive you. That's what he said. I'll forgive you for the sake of your daughter. And I will have you back and we'll pretend none of this ever happened. At that point, really there wasn't much he could do to hurt me or frighten me because in my going back to my normal life, I don't know anybody in Hollywood, so their opinion of me doesn't really matter. And because I was actually not going to continue looking for work in the entertainment industry, but actually went to work in private. Actually, I went to work for, it was Atonement. I went to work for a company that helped charities and nonprofits get funding. But because I wasn't going to be looking for anything in that circle, there was really not very much he could threaten me with. At one point, he did remind me that he had everybody sign non-disclosure agreements. He was exceptionally paranoid. During my time with him, not only did he have people sign non-disclosure agreements, but he also asked people to provide him their social insurance numbers, their social security numbers, which he claimed were only in case of an accident or something happened to them so that he would be able to take care of their families if they were injured or hurt. And some people did provide that information for him. Others did not. And he reminded me of this non-disclosure agreement, et cetera, to which I suggested to him that if he could find a single non-disclosure agreement with my signature on it, that I would review it and review my obligations under it, but that I didn't think he'd be able to find one. And as far as I know, he's never found one with my signature on it. So even if he did, I would challenge it in its legality because I know that I drafted up non-disclosure agreements. I'm certainly not a lawyer. And I'm not convinced that that they were legally enforceable agreements that he had us provide. Regardless, even if they were legally enforceable and I had an obligation under one, if he could find one with my signature on it, I still would say the same thing at the end of the day. I would rather face a penalty than allow him to continue to do this to other people.
Okay. Did you mention to me, and I don't remember the name, but it's a name I haven't, you haven't repeated. I think when we first talked, his name was Perlman?
Ron Perlman was, again, Ron Perlman was one of the people that Troy was trying to do business dealings with in regard to Revlon, and that Revlon Tower. As well, Ron Perlman at one point represented a number of musicians. It is my understanding that he himself may be in jail due to fraud at this time. But I don't believe that they were partners in that sense. I believe that Mr. Perlman had quite a bit of money, and Mr. Stratos was looking for investment from him. I'm not sure if he ever did receive cash from Mr. Perlman or not. He may have.
I think I know of a fraudster named Perlman, which is why the name struck. But I thought it was Lou Perlman, maybe.
It's possible. I know Ron Perlman was the person that Mr. Stratos was directly involved with. That was in New York. Again, my understanding is that was through Revlon.
Okay.
That he may have also had dealings with some boy band in the sort of early 90s as part of his business dealings.
Perlman did.
And that Troy was...
You're talking about Perlman did. Okay, that's the Perlman I'm thinking about. I guess I have his first name wrong. But now that you mentioned the boy band, I remember that, yes.
Yeah, so he was an individual that Mr. Stratos was trying to get investment from. I'm not sure if he ever did receive investment from that avenue. He didn't get a lot of money out of New York. He was much more successful getting money in Las Vegas and in Los Angeles, which is where he concentrated during my period of time with him the majority of his time. His other great love was naturopathic medicine, so he spent upwards of a couple $100,000 in a year on naturopathic treatments, cleanses, and other types of treatments. Health was a very The appearance of health was an important concern to Mr. Stratos.
Okay. All right. Is there anything that I've not asked you about that you think I should have asked you about, or anything that you wanted to talk about I've not given you a chance to cover?
I don't think so. Like I said, so much has happened in that year that's just so foreign to me, and in the 6 or so years since then, my life has taken a number of different turns, much more positive, I think. That I can't think of anything immediately, but if I do think of anything, I will contact you and amend the statement with any other details that I find relevant.
Okay. Anybody threaten you with anything, promise you anything, give you anything to get you to make the statement?
Not at all. In fact, I don't expect to receive anything for this statement.
Okay. You know what perjury is?
I do indeed know what perjury is, and I represent that these statements are true to the best of my ability and knowledge, statements on the things that I saw while I worked for Mr. Stratos.
Okay. Well, that will conclude the statement of Tamara Hegan. The time is about 6:51 in the evening. Thank you very much.